and in the worst of worlds at the same time. Later, the best of the worlds turned out to be the digital world, the great digital armies that here are in the service of the current government of President Bukele. The number of people and the production form of his virtual mobs or trolls have been exposed. As a result, here there is a machine. On the other hand, the worst of worlds is the real world. According to the United Nations World Food Program, poverty has increased in El Salvador. When this government came to power, poverty rate stood at 19%. This percentage has increased significantly, and today we are talking about a very high percentage of people. We have a population of 6.5 million, and the World Food Program estimates that 1.8 and almost 2 million people live in El Salvador who are on the verge of starvation. So there are a lot of lies. When it comes to media, you have to be able to analyze very well, otherwise you can get it wrong. Look, previous governments, even the right-wing governments from the Nationalist Republican Alliance, ARENA, tried to somehow negotiate with the gangs. Leaked information indicates that they had contacts to establish some kind of agreement with these gangs. The first FMLN government, the left-leaning Farabundo Martí Front for National Liberation with Mauricio Funes, attempted to negotiate with the gangs. There was talk of a famous agreement, and they negotiated with the gangs, and even the Organization of American States entered the process. At that time, there was a lot of violence in the streets and throughout the country. When Bukele came to office, he had secret and non-public negotiations with the gangs. This issue was revealed in the audio files that were released. They never published it publicly. Under previous administrations, approximately 10 of the 14 main gang leaders were jailed. Here, they're called RANFLA, which is considered as a main committee with the management of gangs. Due to the crimes committed by these prisoners in America, the issue of their extradition to America was raised. At this time, the current government, in a judicial coup, dissolved the Supreme Court of Justice and the Constitutional Court and imposed a new Supreme Court of Justice. This work is referred to as a judicial coup. At this time, in May 2021, the legislature came into action and virtually all extradition proceedings were halted, and this administration agreed with the gang leaders not to extradite them to America. So, how can there be a fight against the gangs when you agree with the gangs not to extradite them in exchange for a reduction in murders? In addition, a very important news was published here, and that was the release of the third leader of these gangs who is known as Crook. He was released from prison by a government agent. That government agent takes him to a luxury apartment hotel for one night. He takes him to Guatemala, arms him, and lets him through. America arrests him in Mexico. Crook's trial made everyone here very angry because he disclosed important things there. So there's a secret negotiation with the gangs.
We're going to take a short break now, and we'll be back with Walter Raudewals in a few minutes.
We continue with Walter Raudewals. We were saying that there are a series of statistics that are sometimes manipulated and not accurate. These statistics are about crimes. Continue, please.
Adelante, por favor.
Bueno, entonces, mi planteamiento es que esta...
So what I'm suggesting is that this apparent reduction is a fragile peace based on a secret agreement with the gangs, which has now been exposed. This agreement will have many consequences because when this agreement is lost, this issue is known as mafia peace. This issue has been widely reposted on social media. So I also said that the best of worlds is in social media and the worst of the worlds is in the reality. Because this situation raises the main issues such as crime, which is in a very bad condition. Poverty and hunger in El Salvador are concealed and may not be apparent in social media. El Salvador does not produce as much as it consumes and has to import. El Salvador's economy basically revolves around $7 billion in income that El Salvadorians send to their relatives in the form of remittances from America and communities far from El Salvador's homeland in Canada and Europe. This is their only support. Foreign investment has fallen since the time of coronavirus and has not yet returned to its previous state. Some large garment production workshops that existed in the textile industry are gone. Agriculture has been completely damaged, so the country is run only by remittances. El Salvador exports people. Many of our brothers are forced to flee because there are no living facilities. What I'm suggesting is that we have the best world in the digital space and social networks, but the worst world in real life. As a result, we have two versions of El Salvador here. I want to delve into this issue more deeply. To understand this element conceptually, note that Bukele is an American laboratory. When I say America, I mean its imperial position. They're working with different gangs and they're getting results. They get results because they are people outside the political system and model. They take advantage of the weakness of political parties, corruption, and unacceptability. But they simply embellish this unfavorable situation and support it with new technologies and social networks. They gain attractiveness and create interesting characters using their powers. An example is Javier Milei in Argentina. Ecuador is another example. So imperialism is proposing and testing various models, and it has achieved its desired result in El Salvador. According to this explanation, in Argentina and almost in the same way in Ecuador, they want to control these countries with this method.
Walter, in the same context, American imperialism and the West in general created Daesh in West Asia as a way to destabilize everything and intervene, and as we all know, to implement its own policy. It seems that here the issue of drug trafficking, gangs and crime and security are issues that are always not topics in the hegemonic media, and they talk about crime every day. People want their lives to be protected, and the eyes are directed towards the governments that you mentioned at the end of your speech. And that's how we find out about Noboa and Milei. We see how governments are becoming police states and how public liberties are being eroded. How is this in El Salvador today?
Well, in El Salvador, a state of emergency was passed that takes away all constitutional guarantees and rights. March 28 marks 3 years of this emergency status. In this extraordinary situation, they can arrest you on the street. They will take you to the jail and you have no rights. You don't have even the right to defend yourself because they hold a brief trial for 300 prisoners. International and human rights organizations have constantly complained about this shameless violation of human rights. So there's an extraordinary situation that allows the police, the soldiers of the armed forces and the military to arrest people on the street and even arrest you in your own home. Therefore, the most basic rights, such as the right to respect the place of residence, freedom of movement, etc., have been lost in this extraordinary situation. And we have been in this awful situation for 3 years now.
Walter, this is how I understand that there are over 65,000 prisoners, and of course over 8,000 were forced to be released because they were taken without charge. And they also say that the leaders of labor unions and the people who have been arrested, some of them were arrested at their place of work due to non-payment of damages and similar reasons.
Mire, es terrible, digamos, es terrible, es un régimen de terror, es un régimen de terror.
The situation is dire, it is dire. It's a regime of intimidation, a regime of intimidation. I cannot verify these numbers because the permission to enter the prisons has not been given to the international bodies that carry out the work of verification. There is a very large prison with gang members that they say is the cathedral of gangs. Because one of the provisions of the contract is to create a special prison for them. Most people are in the shadow of prison. We are talking about 70,000 people, but this is the information they give. At first, they denied that they had arrested innocent people. There is a movement of innocent victims of the regime called Movir. They are constantly providing information. The latest information is that until now, more than 270 people have died in prison under torture. No one gives you information. There is no process for this in the courts. It is better to say that there is no law in this matter. Worst of all, the arrest is done in a special way. They have set a quota for the policemen and they have to bring a number of people as prisoners daily. Therefore, they give leave to policemen and soldiers according to the number of people. This is a confidential matter and a terrible violation of human rights. Those who have been released speak of the horrific torture inside the prisons, which are considered crimes against humanity. But in addition, there is a media barracks that say this is a successful process and a successful model that is being practiced around the world. They do these using their media arms, their huge digital armies. It is clear that they will take away any possibility of citizenship from you. During 1 hour, they can put a sentence, an idea, and a thought in the minds of the Salvadorians. Do you know what the government's main campaign motto was during the presidential and regional elections? The main message was this: if you vote against the government, they will release the gang members. This is a message of fear.
Yes, that's right, Walter. Wait, you know what's interesting? How do you assess the results of the elections? Because here we discussed only the percentage of votes of the participants in the elections. 82.7% or something like that. About 48% of the population did not participate in the elections.
Se abstuvo de votar como un 48%.
Acaban de pasar acá dos elecciones, la del 3 de febrero que fue presidencial y de diputado.
Two elections were held here on February 3, presidential and parliamentary elections. Elections turnout was 52%, that is 48% did not participate. Municipalities, regions and members of the Central American Parliament. It was an incredible historical issue because 70% did not participate in this election. There is only talk of the 30% who have participated. They committed fraud in the presidential election because according to the Constitution, the president cannot be re-elected and this is prohibited. Therefore, the mere issue of the president's nomination was a fraud. The entire organizational structure was in favor of this issue, and eventually people have the impression that a fraud has occurred. I will give you a concrete example. When they opened the ballot boxes, there were unfolded votes. I mean, there were voting papers that were not folded. How can they enter that box but not fold it? These papers had to be folded several times to pass through that groove and enter the box. How can there be unfolded votes in the boxes? They were marked with pens other than the official pens of the elections. As a result, the impression that exists among the people now is that there has been an elections fraud and they have not been able to change it with all their media power.
Yes, it is. Walter, we're dealing with fraud and repression. We're faced with unfulfilled promises, for example, four universities that were supposed to be built but were never realized. El Salvador has become the most brutal prison in Latin America. This is Black and White. Thank you.
النقي means the pure, the immaculate, the clean. Al-Hadi means the guide. All the imams came for guidance.
As-salamu alaykum ya ahla bayt al-nubuwa wa mawdi' al-risala wa mukhtalaf al-malaik.
Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety.
This is Dialogue, an introduction into the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Imam Ali ibn Muhammad al-Hadi alayhi salam was a pure source of wisdom and knowledge. Despite his young age, he showed what divinely gifted knowledge really looks like. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him and his holy household. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the 10th divinely appointed Imam, and he was the 10th divinely appointed successor of the Messenger of Allah, peace and blessings upon him. Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam was also the son of the 9th divinely appointed Imam, Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. After Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam answered with the answers of an expert the most difficult of questions posed to him by the Shia scholars and jurisprudents, the Shia leaders at that time had more faith and certainty now of what they had previously believed, that a divinely appointed Imam must have the most knowledge and he must be the most knowledgeable one of his time, regardless of whether he is young or old. And so the knowledge, virtue, and the delving into the sciences of the Holy Quran and the Sunnah of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam astonished the minds and sparked meetings and gatherings in all parts of the Muslim world. At this moment, we invite you to listen to parts of the Arabic text of Ziyarat Jamiatul Kabira by Imam Hadi alayhi salam, along with its English translation. Please stay tuned.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. As-salamu ala a'immatil huda wa masabih at-tuja wa a'lam at-tuqa wa dawin nuha.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Peace be upon the directors of right guidance, the lanterns in darkness, the patterns of piety, the owners of understanding, the endued with thought, the havens of the peoples, the inheritors of the prophets, the perfect specimen, the most excellent call, and the arguments of Allah against the inhabitants of the world, the hereafter and the former world. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon you all.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. As-salamu ala mahal.
Peace be upon the exponents of the recognition of Allah, the centers of Allah's blessing, the essence of Allah's wisdom, the keepers of Allah's secrets, the bearers of Allah's book, the successor of Allah's prophet, and the progeny of Allah's messenger. May Allah send blessings upon him and his household. Allah's mercy and blessings too be upon them.
Wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Peace be upon the Imams, the leaders, the guides, the chiefs, the authorities, the defenders, the protectors, the people of the reminder, the men in authority, the left ones by Allah, his select, his party, the case of his knowledge, his argument, his path, his light, his proof. Allah's mercy and blessings to be upon them.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. There's this one excerpt from a very long conversation that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam has with one of his friends. Now, we don't necessarily want to speak about the statement in question, but there's something that's very beautiful that comes out about this. And so the conversation eventually reaches a point where Imam al-Hadi says that Allah has exempted certain people who don't have, you know, some of their basic senses, or they're blind, or, you know, they can't, you know, one of their legs is broken, or there's certain things that Allah has exempted certain people from jihad and all other duties that they cannot do. For example, Allah has imposed on wealthy people that they must offer the Hajj and pay the zakat because they have the ability to do that. And Allah has not imposed the Hajj or zakat on poor people. And so Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam continues. He brings up a verse from the Holy Quran, and then he says that this proves that Allah has not imposed on people what is beyond their ability. And thus, this is the soundness of creation. Now, here, this is something that's really important. We don't necessarily want to talk about the statements in question, but this concept, or this higher reality or higher meaning that Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam is trying to convey, and that is that Allah does not impose a certain duty or a responsibility or an obligation upon a human being that they are not able to do, or they don't have the capacity or the capability to do. Now, whether this is prayers, five daily prayers, the wajib prayers, the salah, or whether this is fasting in the holy month of Ramadan, or whether it is any other kind of thing that Allah has made wajib on one hand, or on the other hand, things that Allah has forbidden and made haram for us, both of these things that are obligations and these things which we have been prohibited from, these are all things that are within our capacity and within our capability. And every single one of us is able to accomplish these things. Now, sure, if there are certain, you know, reasons, or there are certain things that prevent us from accomplishing these things, legitimate things, of course, we shouldn't make excuses, you know, but for example, we are poor, we don't have financial means, or we are sick, or, you know, God forbid, we can't hear, or we're blind, or those are different things. But on the whole, people, who are whole, who are healthy, who have all the requirements, we must never think that Allah has forced us to do anything, or that Allah is forcing us to do something that we cannot do. Matter of fact, according to these words of Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala does not impose or put an obligation upon a human being that they cannot fulfill. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you. Because you are
a Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of Muslim Ladies. Well, once again, I have the honor and the pleasure to be here as your host. This is Asma, of course. And here with me, I have the pleasure to sit with Sister Nahid. She's a researcher on women's study. And then let her talk about herself. So, assalamu alaikum, sister.
Assalamu alaikum to you and all your dear listeners. This is Nahid, and I'm so honored to be with you today.
Thank you for my coming pleasure. Here. Well, as for today, we are going to cover up some more of factors. As you know, previously in Muslim Lady, we covered some factors about a perfect marriage. We went through maturity, the awareness that a woman must have. Then we got to some important points like you must be compatible, you must match and fit each other's perspective and definitions. And also we went through this financial compatibility to be stable in your financial status before getting married. Like we talked about the detailed part of it because it has got some aspects into itself. And then also we talked about emotional maturity, which is so important because without that, you're not going to understand each other and also you're not going to have a perfect life. So now we're going to get into some more of these interesting factors.
Yeah, the next factor we're going to talk about is the communication skills. As what I mean is that effective communication is
now
crucial.
This one is the most important one.
Yeah, and it is very crucial. Like, yeah, you should be able to communicate with your partner to understand their needs, to understand what they want from life, and especially in the cases of conflicts and arguments, If you don't have a good communication skill, you're not supposed to face the problem and match the problem with the solutions. Like, you're not supposed to find a correct way to solve your life problems.
Like, there was this study about the divorces that happen in the courts. Like, they have asked men and women, and what they come up with was the result was just like this, that most of these divorces happen because men and women do not have the right skills to communicate with each other. Like, maybe the two of them really love each other, but the problem is they cannot convey their meaning.
Yeah, there are a lot of disagreements. Like, they disagree with each other, but they can't say. If we even ask a lot of couples right now, they will say, like, my husband is not listening to me.
Exactly.
Like, my wife doesn't listen to me. And we are, I guess sometimes we are being too much, like, self-oriented.
Yeah.
We're not seeing the other person. We're not communicating with the other person. And
I must say that, you know, you and me both can look at the same thing, but we're not going to see the same thing. The way we're going to define that thing is differently. Now, the skill, where the skill comes exactly at this point when I come to understand that you're a different personality. Like, even if you are in disagreement with what I say, it does not mean that you're my enemy.
Yeah.
You're having that, and I must accept you with all those disagreements.
You know, life is full of subjective issues.
Exactly.
And, that is what calls for your attention, your understanding of
that
the
is
fact.
Where maturity comes.
Yeah.
Like, you must accept the other person as
and
the way
and
they
the
are.
Skill, you know, it's a whole skill to be able to deal with the other person, with the opposing ideas, and how to find solutions together while you're
together,
different, while your ideas are different, while your mindsets are different, and even your definition of the results are different.
Just try to come to this point that when your partner, when your partner in life has got different perspective from yours, that does not mean that they are your enemies.
Yeah, exactly.
No, you can still have a perfect, lovely life together with accepting all those differences. Like, you can still make decisions while you know that the other person is in disagreement in whatever you have in your mind.
Yeah, exactly. And that is the point that leads to a good life and can just help them. You know, life is sometimes viewed in the idea of the young generation as a change that is so sweet. We will have good memories. We will travel with each other.
Life is going to be so peachy so pink and so everything is so beautiful, but it's not like
that. And when they face the very, very first challenge in life, they start to just give up. Like, I cannot understand you, and because you have the opposite idea of mine, I'm not going to accept
you. The honeymoon phase,
exactly.
They come out of that phase, and then they face the reality. Like, there was a psychologist out there who once said that marriage is just like getting into a place with a climate. But what the youngsters have in their mind is just like this honeymoon stuff that they have in their mind. That
it's like
it's
they
going
just
to
see
be
the first
always
month.
So beautiful. Yeah. It's going to be like the time when you are just betrothed to each other. Like when the time you're getting to know each other, everything is so sweet. Everybody is trying to show a perfect picture of themselves. Maybe even they go to the point in which they do not show their real pictures, their real images.
Those pictures are sometimes fake.
Exactly.
Like,
because you're interested in someone, you try not to show your disagreement. And they would think like, okay, they are in full harmony with my own thoughts.
There's officially no challenge at that time.
Yeah.
Like, they're just both trying to satisfy the other person. And,
exactly.
They don't face any challenges. So that's why they don't see that
the
in life.
The story starts when all those hallucinations
are gone,
and then you get in under the same roof in the same house with the same issues and problem. The story starts right there, and the challenges are going to start right there. So just as we're talking about this honeymoon phase, which is going to be broken one day, let's get into a break.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Muslim ladies here on program. Well, I am Asma, and Sister Nahid is in here. We're talking about the list of issues regarding marriage and the factors that would lead into a perfect marriage. We have covered numerous number of them, but then right now we're going to get into some more.
Yeah, family approval. You know, in Islam, family approval is often considered important before entering into a marriage to ensure support and harmony with the family.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean like we should get into the challenge that some families are just putting in the way of the young people to marriage.
Yeah. Like, unfortunately, headlessly,
yeah,
they would just draw these obstacles in the middle of the road of their children.
Yeah, I'm not talking about those kinds of like following whatever the families are providing you with,
mm-hmm.
like even stopping yourself from marriage because of those obstacles, either by the girl's family or the boy's family. What I'm talking about is that sometimes families, like mothers and fathers, can be the best counselors for their own child because they have seen life better than them. They have seen life
longer
than them. They've
been there and done that.
Yeah. And this kind of counselation can really pave the way for them, like when they know the challenges at that time that we mentioned, that girl and boy are just in the romantic ideal life and they don't mm-hmm. face any challenges, and they're not aware that later on they're gonna face a lot of challenges. If parents, if even family members like sisters, older brothers, if they aware them of the problems, the obstacles, the challenges of life, give them the knowledge of life, give them the true knowledge of life, because here again we have some issues, like some ideas are subjective. Maybe my brother sees some challenges bigger, like exaggerated. But what I mean is that if families provide the couples with the logical information, with acceptable
and
information.
Support.
Exactly. And support, they will choose better and they will start a much better life.
Right now, I must actually address the youngsters, like the girls and the boys, of course. But we're talking to the girls. So girls are the main concern of us. Unfortunately, some of the girls get into wrong decisions just because of that childish idealism and that, unfortunately, idiotic romanticism sometimes, I
must
say.
We can refer to the fact that they're not emotionally mature.
Exactly. Like, they get into these problematic decisions that would destroy their entire life.
Yeah.
Even though their parents have warned them many times, but they did not pay any heed to it. The result is that they're going to destroy the beautiful future they might have had with another person with the wrong decision they're going to make. So I must say that sometimes, yes, we have seen it a lot of times that families would do things subjectively. Like, they would go for their own selves and what they want for their children. But unfortunately, what they're doing unconsciously is to hurt and destroy their children's future. Now, aside from that, we have seen a lot of these examples that the children do not pay any attention to what their parents say, though what their parents are just telling them is so logical.
Yeah, they're seeing the beyond, you know?
Yeah, they're seeing beyond the curtains. So the children, unfortunately, do not pay any attention, and the result is so, unfortunately, scary.
Yeah, and that's why this factor is mostly for the young girls and boys mm-hmm. who are on the edge of marriage.
There is this obstacle that you actually, as the guys who want to marry, see it as an obstacle coming from your parents. Just give it double thinking.
Yeah.
Like, stop and think. Maybe their perspective is going to tell you some other stuff. And not everything that you think is bad is going to be bad for you.
Yeah. Putting yourself in the parents' shoes will give you a new mindset. Like, you'll understand life much better. And that kind of feelings and emotions and the excitement that you have at that time may sometimes stop you from seeing the reality.
Yeah. So family approval is very important. Not that you follow their approval headlessly with no care and consideration of other factors, but give it a second thought. Maybe that's also going to be helpful.
Yeah. And the next factor I'm going to mention is the fact that we should be able to trust people. You know, trust and respect are the two sides of a successful life. And if couples are able to trust each other and understand the respect that they are supposed to have for each other, they can surely have a kind of a good life with challenges for sure. But yeah, they will be able to solve the challenges with the least difficulty, with the least problems within themselves.
And it's not a one-way ticket, you know? It's
yeah,
two ways.
Yeah,
like, trust
sure,
breeds trust.
Yeah, and
it's
also
not
respect,
that I am the only one who's going to give that trust. No,
yeah,
it is a mutual thing. You have to have it on both sides,
and
like the girls
at the same
and the boys.
Time. We are supposed to respect our partner, and our partner for sure is supposed to give that respect
back. I put it this way, that a marriage without respect is actually nothing.
Yeah.
Like, respect is very important.
Yeah, can't agree more. Like, respect is the thing that starts that relationship,
yeah,
leads to better communication. And
that's the backbone of a perfect relationship.
Yeah, exactly.
Respect is so important. Like, what we see in today's world, unfortunately, is that sometimes the couples take respect for granted. Like, they would not care about it too much. And they would think, they would call this as being too friendly with each other. But
yeah,
unfortunately, that's not true. I guess there must be
no,
some sort of
respect. No, being friendly and respecting each other are two different issues. Like,
yeah.
Maybe we are friends, we understand each other, we try to do our best to satisfy each other. But at the same time, we are respecting, we're keeping the respect. We're not officially insulting each other under the label of just being friendly.
Yeah. And I just mentioned that because of this misconception that we see it nowadays. Like, they
yeah,
think they're friends, but under that pretext, they would disrespect each other.
Yeah, exactly.
And which is not a perfect...
That destroys
an ideal way of having a relationship. So, yes, thank you, sister.
My pleasure.
Still, I guess it was so interesting, and still there are so much more to know about the important factors to have a perfect marriage. But then this was all the time that we had for today's episode. Until another session, I just leave you to God's never sleeping eyes, and wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
I know I'm waiting for something. Something to happen to me. But this waiting comes with trials and challenges. Nothing in life is free.
The new Trailblazers.
One of the oldest and most widespread diseases in the world, cancer has always existed and is found in all living things, including plants. It was once thought to be related to the humours, to be contagious or viral in origin. Today it is believed that the cause may be genetic. In every age, new weapons have been unsheathed against cancer, but none have succeeded in vanquishing it. And yet scientists now are able to decipher some of its most intricate processes. Could these advances have been misleading? Could they have in fact led the scientific community astray?
It now appears very likely that we got lost in the details.
Our focus was wrong. We were looking at the details of the engine in the car when that wasn't really the problem.
We tend to research the details without seeing the big picture. We lose the forest for the trees.
Einstein said, for an idea that people don't think is crazy in the beginning, there is no hope.
The time has come in America when the same kind of concentrated effort that split the atom and took man to the moon should be turned toward conquering this dread disease.
It's now been over 40 years since the war against cancer was declared by one government or another.
La lutte contre le cancer s'est fixée comme objectif.
70% of the cancers that were fatal in the 1950s can now be cured. But such undeniable achievements are, in the end, relatively minimal. In spite of the many billions that have been invested in cancer research in the last half century, mortality rates have not decreased as much as expected. The disease continues to kill 8 million people every year. But how well do we really know this enemy? And to begin with, how do we define it?
When you take these cells from the person and put it in a dish, or from an animal and put it in the dish, the genes are not fixed. They are regulated by context. They are regulated by microenvironment. So that just clarified a lot of things for me, that, again, context or microenvironment. And in this case, the architecture of the tissue was very, very important. And once you destroyed the architecture, that, in combination with the oncogene, could make a tumor.
In a forest, if there's a plant or an animal species that proliferates to the point of destroying the ecosystem, that is literally the equivalent of cancer in the body. Rather than seeing the body as something that functions under the centralized control of our DNA, if we see it as a self-regulating system, like a forest or an ocean, we will then start to look at how the element that is proliferating gets access to nutritional resources and will study the predators. So, for example, if a certain type of rabbit suddenly begins to multiply to the point of destroying the forest, we're not going to say, oh, the rabbit has mutated. We would wonder instead if carrots hadn't become more abundant for some reason, or if some of the other species that would normally compete with the rabbits hadn't disappeared. Or whether the foxes that kept a check on the rabbit population hadn't some kind of problem that year. And so all of a sudden, instead of looking for mutations, you're faced with a more global vision of balances and imbalances.
People like me have argued, instead of looking at all of these changes all the time, the genetic changes and all this bioinformatic analysis and the constant need to sequence, as maybe we should just step back and look at some other ways to think about cancer.
There are various ways of changing tumor metabolism, of improving it. You can do it through your diet, in other words, by reducing the amount of glucose that you consume, and by reducing the amount of food that you eat in general. That's one possibility. However, it hasn't really been tested. Many people do it, but to be honest, we have very few of the proper, clear-cut kind of studies that scientists are so fond of. Another way is to work with the kinds of drugs that specifically target those circuits. That's the approach we've chosen because it's easier to study.
There are limitations, though, of the work done in petri dishes and in animals. And
in relation to metformin, one of the major concerns is that much of the work has used metformin in concentrations that are unsafe in humans. So it's very difficult to translate much of that work into the clinical setting.
Every year, over 1 million women around the world are diagnosed with breast cancer, and nearly half of them will die from the disease. Yet testing an old medication like metformin, which might prove to be effective, was an uphill battle. It took 10 years for Pamela Goodwin to obtain the funds needed for this study.
When we started the company in 2002, and again it was based on targeting this unique metabolic properties of cancer cells, we were probably one of maybe 20 or 40 people that we spoke with who were even aware of Otto Warburg. And occasionally we would meet with potential investors who were older, guys in their 60s and 70s, who when we described what we were doing, they would say, oh, you're targeting the Warburg effect. The idea is that if you can develop an effective therapy that really targets the Warburg effect, you may have a much broader therapeutic that would treat a much wider variety of cancers than would be the case with these molecularly targeted approaches.
Threshold Pharmaceuticals is testing a new drug called TH302 in several countries. In Germany, oncologist Peter Hohenberger is using it on 10 patients who have advanced stage cancer with disseminated tumors. The aim of the trial is to evaluate the effectiveness of combining TH302 with other treatments.
In a therapeutic study, what we want to find out is how effective the treatment is. This can be measured by the fact that the tumors are shrinking, and so that's a positive sign. Our primary goal, however, is to extend the life of our patients. Of course, it takes a long time to develop a drug that we can then prescribe for our patients. It's a process that often takes 4 or 5 years. Before we can use a drug, all of the relevant studies have to be conducted in order to prove that it actually offers something more. For our patients, of course, the procedure is too long.
Since it takes such a long time to get a new drug out and onto the market, many patients will never get the opportunity to try a new treatment, even if it has a good chance of prolonging their lives.
The time frame for conventional, standardized clinical trials does not match the time frame of someone diagnosed with cancer, who is in a hurry, and that's understandable.
Since 2009, Dr. Lauren Schwartz has been advocating the idea that a combination of drugs, including metformin, which is already on the market for other diseases, could act on cell metabolism. Tests carried out on mice have indeed been very encouraging. Such drugs are inexpensive, their side effects are already known, and combining them makes them more effective. However, in spite of his repeated requests, he's been unable to obtain the authorization and the funding needed to conduct clinical trials on patients.
Everything we've done has been published. We've had numerous articles in well-known international reviews. And yet there has been absolutely no response. it got to the point that I decided I had to write a book about what I was thinking. And that's when the patients started coming to me. And since those who contacted me knew they had very little time left, I felt I had to inform them of what I thought had a chance of helping them.
Some of the members of the association facing cancer together in the French city of Nantes have decided to try this experimental treatment.
The trials we've conducted come under the heading of compassionate use. Physicians are torn between two obligations, between two laws. On the one hand, trials that are extremely regulated, and on the other, assisting a person in danger. We're authorized to prescribe treatment when it concerns people who are in danger.
Is the treatment prescribed by Dr. Schwarz the miracle we've all been waiting for? He himself refrains from drawing conclusions with regard to a possible or permanent cure.
So far, we've treated, both myself and other people, over 100 patients. And several articles have been published that suggest, and I think the term suggest is the appropriate term, that suggests that we are able to slow down the progression of the disease. In certain cases, we've seen a decrease in the number of tumor markers. Other cases could be called miracles. In the majority of cases, unfortunately, the effect is temporary, and I don't understand why it's only temporary. In other words, they improve, and then afterwards they relapse. But even if we were able to make just a tiny breakthrough, it may not be enough for the patients under my care, but it's still pretty good. Of course, what's also important is to take what we already have, which is far from being perfect, and try to improve it. Combining it with chemotherapy would probably be a good thing, and it's likely there are other agents that could be introduced. At any rate, it's quite clear that we only have a part of the picture.
But I think that the permanent eradication of cancer is unlikely. I recognize this is not going to be a popular view, but it's a realistic view. My goal would be to reduce the incidence as much as we can, and I think it will be important that we manage cancer using agents that are the least toxic that we can use, and that will prolong life as long as possible.
Whether there are new drugs or old drugs, we still don't know how effective they will be. Will the metabolic approach run into the same limitations as the other cancer treatments?
We can't stay up on the surface of things, think that it will be simple, that cancer is a problem that we can solve with three or four drugs. We feel like we're advancing, and as we advance, it's like we're opening up a series of black boxes. We're bringing in some light, but then the light shows us that a little bit further on, there's another black box. With this new idea, which emphasizes metabolism as an important factor, it is imperative that we not fall prey to the sort of oversimplification that could lead to the same kind of problems and disappointments that we had with the previous paradigms.
It will be important, though, to conduct the proper trials. And those trials will be large. They'll be much larger than the 3,600-patient study we're doing. They could include tens of thousands of individuals.